even I, looking at it, go, that can't be real.
The major goal was definitely to see the giant planets.
And it was this amazing pace of discovery, finding things, you know, possibly deep oceans on Europa, you know, volcanoes on Io, all that kind of stuff.
Why have two spacecraft? Why not just have one?
Hello, welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
That's me. Last month it was all about interstellar space. So this month, inspired by listener Siraj, we're going to feature the most famous spacecraft to leave the solar system, Voyager 1 and 2. How have they shaped our understanding of the solar system and what lies beyond, and how are they getting on as well?
We'll be speaking with Deputy Project Scientist of the Voyager mission, Dr. Jamie Rankin, to cover the basics. Plus, and this is very exciting, Andrian, Creative Director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Message Project, who worked with her husband, Carl Sagan, to produce the golden records attached to both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, will be here as well.
I'm so excited.
And obviously, the biggest of our stellar lineup is Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society.
Highly debatable, though.
It depends on your definition of biggest. Was she just
true,
having a dig?
If we do it by weight, like, possibly.
Oh, no, this has got mean. I didn't mean that.
It's not really okay.
But Robert, what does the Voyager mission mean to you?
Well, as a man in my 50s who's not sensitive to these kind of terrible attacks, no, it almost matches my interest in the universe we live in. So I was thinking about this and I thought it's one of my earliest memories of space exploration because I'm too young for Apollo. I was born after Apollo 11. Don't remember any of them at the time. And I don't remember the launch of the Voyager probes because I was only 7. But I do remember that when they got to Jupiter and Saturn and then for Voyager to Uranus and Neptune, because you had these amazing images. They were processed so much better. They looked so much sharper than the earlier Pioneer probes that had just gone to Jupiter and Saturn. And it was this amazing pace of discovery, finding things, you know, possibly deep oceans on Europa, you know, volcanoes on Io, all that kind of stuff, details of the ring system. And you have to remember as well that this was a time when there wasn't a lot of planetary exploration going on. The Apollo program had long since come to an end, and it was basically the Russians doing stuff with space stations. So it was really, really exciting. It really got a lot of attention. And it also took advantage of this unusual time when the outer planets were lined up in such a way, so everything from Jupiter through to Neptune, to allow a grand tour whereby you could send a probe to Jupiter and use its gravity to accelerate the spacecraft onto Saturn and then Saturn onto Uranus and Uranus onto Neptune. So that only happens about every 175 years. So the space scientists in the 60s and 70s were really, really keen to exploit it.
Cheers, Robert. We'll catch up with you later in the show for some more questions and some stargazing.
The Voyager missions blasted into space 46 years ago. Voyager 2 went first in August 1977, followed by Voyager 1 a few weeks later. The mission itself was originally intended to last 5 years and focus on just Jupiter and Saturn, but 5 years became 12, and they just kept on going and going and bringing with them a close-up of all the outer planets, 48 moons, and a better understanding of these planets' ring systems and their magnetic fields. So how important is this mission and where are they now? Over to Dr. Jamie Rankin, who's Voyager's current deputy project scientist.
The major goal was definitely to see the giant planets. Even to this day, the flybys of Uranus and Neptune, those are the only flybys by a spacecraft. And then after the main mission part was over, they basically set their sights on going as far as they could and seeing where the boundaries of our solar system are and how it interacts with the interstellar medium. That mission started in the early 90s after they turned off the cameras and took the infamous pale blue dot photo. They went into an interstellar mission phase and they didn't know what they would find. They didn't know where the boundaries were and they just wanted to keep on going to see what we could see.
And you mentioned there the pale blue dot image. It's iconic. I know that word is overused, but it really is. So if anyone hasn't seen that, what is that image?
So that image was taken by Voyager 1, and it was amongst the last images that they took before they turned off the cameras because it was at such a far away distance that not enough photons were reaching those cameras to actually make sense of things. So as their near last images that they were taking, they looked back, they took this picture that was basically a part of the family portrait where they're trying to gather pictures of kind of each of the planet's images of the solar system. And the pale blue dot itself is the photograph that was taken of Earth. And it was taken on Valentine's Day, which is a fitting day to take that, 1990. And there's this really just small speck. It gave a first time a real glimpse of how small we are in this place of the universe, in this like new way that hadn't been done before.
Why have two spacecraft? Why not just have one?
The once in 176-year planetary alignment caused people to want to really make this work, so they had two spacecraft. But as far as exploring space, it's been advantageous for many reasons. The two Voyagers launched slightly different, going different speeds, different times, slightly different times of their planetary flybys. And that also has allowed them to be spaced apart. And so, for example, as an event from the sun might overtake the Voyager spacecraft, it's hugely advantageous to see one in one spacecraft and then see one in the other and get two blips in time of a same event, for example. They fared differently through the history. There's a slightly differing set of current operational instruments. So the Voyager 1 spacecraft can measure magnetic fields and cosmic rays, and Voyager 2 can do that too. That's common between them. And then there's a slight difference in how the radio instruments operate. It's a more fully functional radio instrument on Voyager 1, and there's some measurements they have on Voyager 2 as well, but not the full frequency spectrograms. And then the plasma instrument on Voyager 1 doesn't work because it failed somewhere around the Saturn flyby, I believe. But the Voyager 2 plasma instrument does work, and it's been taking really valuable measurements. So people have been very excited, just even with these little small differences, even though all these same instruments are on board, the operational differences of which one survived through history, you know, has gotten people very excited about both spacecraft and having this really nice full suite working on both spacecraft.
So let's get on to some of the discoveries. What would you say have been some of the biggest findings from the mission?
So definitely these planetary flybys were amazing. All the information we have on Uranus, Neptune is just extraordinary because that was the only to date spacecraft flybys of by Voyager 2 to those two planets. So everything from the side tilt, the differences between those planets and the other gas giants of Saturn and Jupiter caused us to think about those bodies in different ways. When they did the flyby of Jupiter, they saw on this tiny moon, Io, a lump coming out the side, and they saw a plume of gas. And at first they thought that was maybe a smudge on the image. They didn't know what this was. And they figured out that that was the first volcano on any body not on Earth that they had ever seen. And now we know there's many, many, many volcanoes on that little moon. There's volcanoes in other places as well. But that was surprising. But I think in a bigger picture sense, the more recent data is equally as extraordinary, which is figuring out how far does our solar system extend and how far do the materials of our sun extend. Nobody knew where those boundaries were, but we also discovered what is it that these materials of our sun are protecting us from. So interstellar space has all this radiation out there in the form of what they call cosmic rays. That's just particles that are energized by the explosions of supernova and other processes. And it turns out that 85% of the flux of cosmic rays in interstellar space gets shielded by our sun's materials by the time it reaches Earth. And so it's worth asking the question that without our heliosphere and without this bubble of material that our sun forms that evidently seems to be protecting us, would life exist without this? And that's a big question.
Absolutely huge question, right? To be quite honest.
Right.
So let's talk about that just a little bit more. Where are they now?
All right. So Voyager 1 is the farthest man-made object from our solar system. And it is 22.5 light hours away. So that means that if we were to send signal and wait for that to respond, Voyager 1 to send its response, That would take just under 2 days to arrive back at us. And it is at roughly 160 astronomical units away. And that's roughly more than the distance from here to Pluto, past our solar system's boundary of the heliopause. And Voyager 2, it crossed the heliopause boundary a little later. That's around 135 astronomical units away.
And what information are they collecting, and how can you still use that data today?
So they're not taking pictures of planets anymore. But
damn,
I know, right? Bummer. But they are measuring all sorts of things about the, I guess, electrifying elements of space, you could say. So there's magnetic fields that can be measured. There's radio waves that can be measured. There's particles, cosmic rays, this radiation. Basically, the environments, a lot of the environments of the plasma itself that makes up the interstellar medium. And what we discovered once the Voyagers reached interstellar space is how quiet it is out there compared to inside our solar system, compared to outside.
Is there a cutoff? Do we know how long or how far the Voyagers will keep going?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there's two things that are fascinating here. First thing is the scientific question of how far will the sun's influence still be felt in the interstellar medium? And we don't know yet. There's no signs of that decaying away. And we're hoping that the Voyagers can go as far as possible so we can see if there is some change where the sun's influence isn't felt as much. Another thing is these are 46-year-old spacecraft. I don't think anybody really expected them to go that long. So we're kind of surprised by that. I mean, these continual science discoveries are incredible on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's kind of groundbreaking in terms of how long can a spacecraft operate. We're very hopeful. Maybe just 3 years, we'll have a 50 years, you know, spacecraft. Yeah, that'd be incredible. And I think that's also just a testimony to so much hard work and diligence from the team in keeping it operating, you know, over these many decades, multi-generationally.
Thank you to Dr. Jamie Rankin. So, Becky, let's go back to some of those Voyager discoveries. You know, how important were they, and what were some of those most transformative ones, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost easier to list like the things that we, you know, didn't change our understanding from Voyager did change, right? I think the big ones that stand out for me in terms of discoveries is just all the sort of moons and rings that it detected around the gas giant planets that we just didn't know were there. Jupiter, it detected 2 new moons in a thin ring. Saturn, 5 new moons, and also a new ring of Saturn, the G ring as well, that we didn't know was there. And then Uranus, it discovered 10 new moons, plus like 2 wow. rings around Uranus. Like, and then at Neptune, 5 moons and 4 rings, and Neptune's great dark spot. You know, these features that we're so sort of used to seeing in images of Neptune. Like, I feel like, especially for Uranus and Neptune, they were just these sort of fuzzy blue disks before that, you know, just these like round shapes in the sky, and Voyager really sort of gave them features and personalities, you know, before that we just didn't have. I think the biggest one for me is like volcanoes on Io. I can't even imagine what living through that discovery must have been like for the scientists, and the weird surface that it has, and discovering that it is the most geologically active place in the solar system, because like it's something that we just associate with Earth so much, right? And everything else looks like these sort of static blobs in the sky. It's really like...
Yeah. No, and I loved it that when Jamie was saying that when they first saw that plume, they thought it was a smudge on the image. They were like, yeah, is that right? Like, yeah, that first moment must have been incredible.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, like, I mean, continuing on this path of like, oh, you know, realizing Earth's not that special again, is, you know, when they sort of investigated Titan, one of Saturn's moons as well, this thick atmosphere that they found there that was like 90% nitrogen, about 1.6 times the atmospheric pressure of Earth at sea level, right? All of a sudden, it becomes somewhere else in the solar system, you might be able to get liquid on the surface. And having liquid on a surface, again, seems like so much that is just so like Earth's, like that's Earth's characteristic. What are you doing? Like, you know, stealing that glory. So I think Uranus and Neptune though were the most sort of transformative in terms of our understanding though. Like Voyager 2 revealed that Neptune was way more active than we ever thought. Like 1,100 kilometers a second winds on Neptune, an atmosphere made completely of hydrogen rather than the methane that we necessarily thought. It is the methane that gives it its color, but it is still mostly hydrogen. And now, of course, it's also transforming our understanding of interstellar space as well, right? With its finally leaving and actually recording what it found. So I think, you know, I hope discoveries are still coming from Voyager missions in the future too.
I mean, there's so much to go through there. Do you have a favourite one? I have a feeling it might be attached to a certain planet.
I think you might be right, because I think there's only one right answer, and it is Saturn's hexagon, right? Like,
yeah, fair. I mean, it's a good one. It's a good one.
I mean, for those who haven't seen this yet, who haven't heard me harp on about it constantly, there is a storm raging at Saturn's north pole that is hexagon in shape, which was discovered by Voyager 1 when it flew past Saturn. Like, even I, looking at it, go, no, that's not, that can't be real. I can't imagine.
You've literally just put your hands on your head, like, to be like, no.
Like, can you imagine what also, like, you know, people thought when they first saw that image? Like, everything in the universe is rounded, right? Nature likes to make things round. So finding hard angles is just weird. And it's taken, like, decades for us to figure out like what is actually going on. It was a team from the University of Oxford that managed to figure out it might be something to do with standing waves set up by winds in the atmosphere of Saturn, where if you've got two winds going in opposite directions, they can interact to give you this hexagonal shape, which is crazy.
And as of this week, you know, at the point of recording, anything can happen from here on in.
Sure not.
But yeah, communications with Voyager 1 have just come back online. It's sort of been a bit iffy over a period of time. So what happened there?
Yeah, it sort of started sending back gibberish in November 2023 last year. So for about 6 months, it's been operating fine. It's been responding to any like commands that were sent to it, but any like scientific data or engineering data that was sent back just didn't make any sense. It was just complete gibberish. And this is a vintage spacecraft that we're talking about now that we hope will last as long as possible. But we know we'll eventually fail due to age or just a lack of power, more likely. Thankfully, that was not this day. The team at NASA figured out essentially that the fail was due to a single chip failure in one of the boards on Voyager. So that caused some of the onboard computer memory to get corrupted. And so because they couldn't actually replace the chip that failed, they had to do this workaround where they essentially patched the software to other bits of the memory on the computer so that it could run the same again, but then they had to get all of those patches to then communicate with each other and actually work as it used to. So now, having done that, we are getting comms back from Voyager 1, and now they still have to test it to make sure that all of those patches that they did didn't affect, you know, doesn't affect any of the scientific data that they get back from it. So they've got a few more weeks of testing to go, but it's just really promising news that, you know, we've got comms back with it. And also just a reminder that the engineers and the computer scientists at NASA are just incredible problem solvers, that they can also do this with a 53-year-old bit of kit as well.
Yeah, I mean, that does just blow my mind a little bit. It's just incredible.
Now, the Voyager spacecrafts are packed with lots of different instruments. You know, you've got an imaging system, a radio science system, a cosmic ray system, and a magnetometer, just to name a few. But amongst them, placed on the side of each craft, is a 12-inch gold-plated copper record.
These are the golden records containing sounds and images selected to show the diversity of life and culture on Earth for any potential spacefarers that may just find them. Andrian was the creative director of the project, working alongside her husband, Carl Sagan. And I'm excited to say that our editor, Richard Hollingham, spoke to her to find out how they were made.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us on the Supermassive podcast. My first question, really, and you would have been asked this a lot, what did you hope to convey with the sounds of Earth on the discs? You know, the whole idea of the disc with the video and the images. I mean, what was the purpose, the thinking behind it?
Well, Richard, it's great to be with you. And I've had that question before, but I find that as I think about it more deeply over the decades, I find a kind of new understanding. So I'm glad you asked me. What we hoped to achieve was to convey to the beings of a very distant future and very different worlds what it was like to be alive in the spring of 1977, to be young and aware of the dangers that our planet faced. Even then, we were just beginning to really take seriously the prospect of climate change. We were even more concerned about the 60,000 nuclear weapons that essentially put everyone on Earth in a kind of hostage drama. And we knew that in the best of circumstances, even if we don't wreck our own future and we endure, the fact is that even the stars die, even our sun will someday change sufficiently so as to devour the Earth. And we were thinking in those great big timescales of hundreds of millions, even billions of years, because after all, this spacecraft, which was only supposed to last for 5 years, is now still functioning almost 50 years into the project. Of course, we couldn't know that back then, but we had a lot of confidence in the engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory working for NASA in California. And so we wanted to create a lasting document to bear witness with our eyes and ears and hearts and brains to what it was like to be fully alive. And we didn't want it to be just a kind of message from the imperial wizards who had created the spacecraft. We wanted to reflect that planetary perspective that Carl Sagan was so passionately involved in presenting to the planet. And so we wanted to show the diversity of the ways of being alive, both the transcultural diversity, but also the idea of what the other life forms with whom we've yet to make contact on this planet were saying and singing and calling to each other.
Was it a hard sell to the engineers at NASA? You go up to them and say, well, we're going to stick these quite weighty cold records on the side of your lovely spacecraft. Or was it thought about from the beginning? Was it always going to be part of the mission that these were going to be our ambassadors, if you like, from Earth to the cosmos?
Well, this mission of exploration was taking advantage of a rare planetary configuration that only happens once every 175 years. So the last time it happened was the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. So we had this feeling of this window. And because of the success of the pioneer plaques that Carl Sagan, Frank Drake, and Linda Salzman Sagan had created for the Pioneer spacecraft, NASA actually approached Carl in the person of the wonderful John Cassani and invited Carl and Frank to do something for this new mission. And of course, Carl and Frank immediately started thinking, how can we make this a message of greater density of information? And I think it was Frank, the wonderful Frank Drake, who had the idea to make it a kind of phonograph record.
And that was another of my questions, because that's quite clever, because anyone can play a record. As we see, audio technologies have come and gone. We've gone through tape and things like mini discs,
yes,
and CDs. People are still playing records. And you've got instructions as well to anyone who finds these of how to play these records.
Yes, and a stylus is included to actually play the record. So, you know, we were trying to anticipate whatever the possible needs might be of beings whose evolutionary story is so different from ours. And we had enough respect for nature to know that we couldn't really imagine them. All of us knew we could never have imagined an elephant or a giraffe. And so, of course, we couldn't imagine what these extraterrestrials would do. But we did know that the only way they're going to be able to find the spacecraft and then the record is if they're spacefaring beings. And so we immediately assumed that if they had conquered the challenge of space, of interstellar flight, that they would have the wherewithal to figure this out.
Well, I mean, you can see all the contents listed on the Voyager pages of the JPL website. And it's an extraordinary list, and to have got that down onto a record. What struck me just looking at the list before we spoke was it's quite optimistic, I felt. I mean, you mentioned climate change and nuclear war, but actually I felt the images and certainly the music, it's a positive reflection of Earth. I mean, was that a deliberate choice? Because you could, you know, you could fill it with war, or you could have, you know, just the negative things, the awful things that humans do to each other. But actually, I felt it was quite a positive message.
Richard, you put your finger on what was the topic of the most heated debate. Because the question was, is this going to be a merely social gesture? When you meet someone, as Carl said, you usually don't air your dirty laundry at that moment. You want to make a good impression. And because so much is open to misinterpretation, you know, we felt we had to tread carefully. But there were those of us who felt fervently that Cambodia, Auschwitz, the Belgian Congo, that these, the United States, the history of the murder of the Native Americans, the enslavement of people dragged from Africa and brutalized for hundreds of years. There's so many examples of our gravest human failings, our gravest failures as a species. And that's what we talked about the most. And in the end, we decided that we wanted to do was to send a message of the things we took pride in, the things we loved about our planet. And, you know, one of the things that Carl said that was so profound is that the spacecraft itself would speak volumes about us. This is a species in the adolescence of its technological development, making its first baby steps into the Milky Way galaxy. And so that would speak volumes about us. And I also had another opportunity in the sequence of my meditation, the hour-long meditation, which consisted of my brainwaves and my heart sounds, to tell something through my thoughts of the predicaments that we find ourselves in.
That's so fascinating. You know, these spacecraft, again, you can check the exact distances on the JPL website, but 15 billion miles away, Voyager 1, 12 billion miles away, Voyager 2. But they've got a long way to go before they may ever encounter anyone. I wondered if it matters, because creating the art is almost as important as them actually ever being read, or they're ever being discovered. Or do you feel they will one day be discovered?
The chances in the vastness of the space, you know, the Voyagers have been on their way, moving at 38,000, 40,000 miles an hour for 47 years. And still, they're not even a full light day away from us, let alone a light year. Think of how vast the galaxy is. Think of how vast the universe is with billions of galaxies. We really are those little tiny mites on a pale blue dot. And so the chances are slim, but as Carl would say, anything over zero is worth doing. So, you know, these Voyagers will circumnavigate the Milky Way galaxy perhaps a dozen times before they are completely destroyed, and the records that they carry are ruined. And so, you know, anything can happen in that period of time.
Thank you to Andrew. And I'm so thrilled that she agreed to come on this podcast, to be honest. So win for us.
And I'm very jealous that it was Richard that got to talk to her.
Yeah, I know. I was supposed to be me, and I had a work trip that scuppered our plans.
But anyway.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. This is the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and science journalist Izzy Clark.
Before we get on to questions about the Voyager missions, we should really talk about the eclipse and the jealousy that we're all trying to suppress here that Richard actually got to see it. You've had a great time.
There's a lot of jealousy. There's a lot of jealousy coming my way.
How was it? Was it absolutely amazing?
It was amazing. I have to say, we were incredibly lucky because you would not pick Northwest Rural Pennsylvania as a destination to see this particular eclipse. And I really feel for the people who booked their accommodation and booked their flights and everything years and years in advance, as people do for eclipses. And then we just randomly turn up because we happen to be in Pennsylvania. So we were at this state park, Pima Tuning State Park in Pennsylvania. We only actually chose where we're going to go on the morning of the eclipse. It's really just on the Ohio border up near Erie. And it was just a beautiful location. There were families, fishermen, people having picnics. But it was cloudy. I mean, it was really cloudy. And we just thought, well, it's going to go dark and at least we'll experience it in America in a rural setting. It's a lovely location. But as the day went on, the clouds started to clear and we started to get more and more optimistic. And by the time of the eclipse, it was completely clear. So we just saw every part of it. So the sun gradually being sort of eaten away by the moon, that toenail moon just before when I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, there's the toenail moon, and I, you know, really hated myself for that.
You're welcome.
And then, you know, when we got totality, because, you know, people were interested in, it was really interesting being there with non-astronomers, because people were sort of watching, occasionally putting their, you know, solar glasses on, which had been given out locally, looking up at the sun kind of being eaten away. And they were sort of, yeah, that's quite interesting. It's quite cool. But when the totality came, there was like this, whoa, right away across the park. You could hear it across the lake. It was incredible. And we were, you know, just so lucky to see it completely clear, see those prominences as well. I mean, it was a spectacular eclipse.
So many of them, wasn't it?
Yeah, so just very lucky. I didn't use my phone during it. I just
enjoyed the moment. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, if you've not seen an eclipse, I thoroughly recommend it. I also recommend Pennsylvania State Parks because they're great.
Amazing if you can do two in one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds a little bit more glamorous than me watching it on the sofa on iPlayer. But
iPlayer, yeah, I did
that. I was like, this will do. This is fine. Oh, it sounds amazing.
Well, I guess if you recommended eclipses, Richard, I guess we should chat about when the next ones are.
Yeah, well, I've started to get the bug. That was my third. Oh, yeah. I mean, but I've only seen two because the first one was in the UK. So I've seen the last two US ones, and we're already looking into Egypt. But everything already is booked up, you know, when you look to anywhere across the next eclipse.
Oh, I haven't even thought that, like, bookings would have opened yet and stuff like that for flights, especially because I was looking because, I mean, for those in the US, they've almost got used to having one every, like, 7 years now. But sad to say, for listeners in the US, the next one that actually crosses the lower 48 again is in 2045. So you've got a bit of a time to wait. You might have to travel. I've got my eye on the 2026 eclipse that comes across northern Spain, but also goes across Reykjavik in Iceland.
Ooh.
And I think most people are like, oh, you know, Iceland, not exactly the best weather. But I think it's a high risk, high reward situation because there is a chance that you could see the aurora during totality.
Oh, wow.
Which would be the most incredible sight ever, right? And so I'm kind of like, I could go to northern Spain, but at the same time, do I want to risk the aurora? Yes, I think so.
Group trip to Reykjavik.
Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely need a supermassive trip to that.
As you said, there's another one in 2027 that crosses southern Spain, North Africa, and the Arabian Peninsula. But then there's also one in July 2028 that crosses Australia, for any Australian listeners out there. But it goes straight over Sydney. Like, totality passes over, like, the Opera House.
Oh, wow.
Which is just, I mean, come on. I've got to go to that one.
that's going to be the biggest Instagram ever, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're looking at the 2027 eclipse across Egypt, and already hotels are all booked up. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, it is. So flights don't open, but I mean, I guess you could take the risk, and you know, from my experience of the Eurovision Song Contest. So we didn't book accommodation, but we were right at the front for one of the rehearsals last year. It was brilliant. And then I checked on accommodation in Liverpool just 24 hours before and got a hotel room, brilliant hotel room, for a fraction of the price they were charging a year earlier.
Oh, so God, you that could is take high the risk, risk.
But look, you know, I'm not an advisor on these things, but you know, you could do that.
Noted. Yeah, I was just going to say, also, we should mention, amazingly, a handful of people in the UK saw the partial bit of the eclipse. The weather was largely terrible, but in Orkney, one of our fellows, Callum Potter, cycled round the island of Rousay, where he lives, and saw the sun setting over the Atlantic with a beautiful bite out of it. And also someone managed to see it from Gairloch Youth Hostel in the Highland, out on the Isle of Harris. Amazing. There's really nice photos. We put them on our website, so do take a look. So, you know, I felt a bit bad about recommending it, given the number of people that simply didn't see anything at all, but it turns out at least maybe 10 people across the UK managed it. So better than zero.
Yeah, absolutely,
that's an order of magnitude better.
Exactly.
So back to Voyager and on to some questions. And Becky, Chef Mike Barkley asks, will Voyager ever reach another star system, and if so, when?
Well, eventually, Mike, but it's a long time to wait, unfortunately. So let's do a bit quick, like, back of the envelope calculation. So Voyager 1 is traveling at about 38,000 miles an hour. Voyager 2, about 34,000 miles an hour. So let's use Voyager 1 because it's just marginally faster. 38,000 miles an hour is 17 kilometers a second. So it sounds fast, right? But to travel just one light year, which is how far that light travels, you know, at 300,000 kilometers a second, like, you know, how far it goes in a year, time is distance over speed. So it would take Voyager 1 about 17,500 years to go one light year.
Wow. Okay.
So for context, the nearest stars are 4 light years away. You know, Proxima Centauri is about 4 light years away. So that speed, it's going to take you about 70,000 years or so. If it was going in that direction, which it's not, it's heading towards the constellation of Ophiuchus as well. So will it ever? Probably in our lifetimes.
No. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Don't wait up for that one. And then following that, Gem W asks, can we work out which ones they could eventually fly past? So I assume that's star systems.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit more complicated than you might initially think, because the stars aren't in fixed positions relative to each other. So our current closest star is Proxima Centauri, but that's not always going to be the case. The sun is moving, the other stars are moving, right? And so what actually happens if you sort of run a model forward based on the sort of directions and speeds that stars are going at the minute, is that a star called Jalice 445, which is currently 17 light years away from Earth, but in 45,000 years or so, it will become our closest star for around about a few thousand years, about 3.5 light years away. So just ever so slightly closer than Proxima Centauri. And when that happens, Voyager 1 will pass 1.6 light years away from Jalice 445. And so technically then, the sun will no longer be Voyager's closest star. It will be Jalice 445.
I'm really enjoying that. That's great.
Which is pretty cool, right? Yeah. It's cool to think about. I mean, it's just a little red dwarf star, and like, you're not even going to be able to see it with the naked eye, I don't think, when it even gets that close. But still, it's kind of cool to think that at some point, you know, it'll be like, if I desperately need a star, which way's closer? Not the way I came. That way.
Amazing. Okay, great question from Jem. And Robert Benji182 asks, could you see NASA going back to Uranus or Neptune anytime soon?
Yeah, Benji, that's a very good question. I think the answer is maybe.
We hope so.
Exactly, yeah. American planetary scientists all over the world would like to see that happen. And they placed it as a high priority in what's called their decadal review, their sort of astronomy priorities for the decades ahead. And it's 714 pages long, this document, I should say, so don't dive through it all. But nothing has been confirmed. So there are sort of studies around it, but it's a long way to go. One of the probes that was proposed would be something that orbits Uranus and its moons. And the other would be one that orbits Neptune, and particularly looking at Triton as well, because that's quite an exciting target, a moon with sort of ice geysers on it and so on. And Uranus is a bit more likely. But if it happens, it probably wouldn't be even launched until the second half of the 2030s. And it wouldn't get there until around 2050. So I was just running the clock forward thinking, yeah, I'll definitely be retired. But, you know, I'd be more than it'd be an amazing thing to see, I think. And everybody would really, really love to get another look at the ice giants.
OK, Becky, Old Black Crow asks, what is the theoretical distance limit of our current receiving stations? Are there any plans to upgrade them?
Yeah, so currently NASA, ESA, JAXA, ISRO, all of these space agencies use the Deep Space Network, the DSN, to communicate not just with Voyager 1, but with rovers on Mars and telescopes like JWST and Gaia at L2. It's like this big network of radio telescopes worldwide, and it gives us coverage like 24 hours a day with these antennae that are at least like 70 meters, that's about 230 feet across. Now, a spacecraft gives out a radio signal, like a certain energy or strength, right? And that then spreads out as it travels through space. So it ends up being much weaker by the time that it reaches Earth. So there's not just sort of the noise sensitivity of the antenna to take into account, but also like the strength of the signal giving out by the spacecraft. Because as long as it's giving out a strong enough signal, no matter how far distant it goes, we should still be able to detect it here on Earth, right? So it's a little bit of a weird one, because even just like, yes, we can upgrade the system by just adding more antenna. If you put more radio antenna over a larger area, that sort of increases the size of your effective sort of radio telescope that you're picking things up with as well. And that means that you can detect weaker signals above like whatever noise background you have. Now, I admit, I did try to find some numbers to put numbers on this for you, but it was very, very difficult to find. I can't find anywhere that like NASA records this is like the strength of the signal or whatever that's given out. And this is sort of like the noise floor on the Deep Space Network. But what I could find was that the Voyager 1 signal that it gives out is 1/10 of a billionth of a trillionth of a watt by the time that it reaches Earth. It's like 10 to the minus 22 or minus 23 or something like that, like a zero with like 22 zeros after it and then a one. So as it gets further away, that signal is going to get weaker, but I don't think it's near that noise floor of the Deep Space Network just yet. I think what's more likely to happen is that it will run out of fuel first before we actually are not able to detect a signal from it anymore.
Nice. Okay. And Robert, Lucy San wants to know, what's your favorite Voyager image? In brackets, I need a new desktop background.
And is it the Saturn hexagon?
Yeah.
We know what Becky's favourite Voyager image is, don't we? Without a doubt, yeah. For me, it's not even necessarily the planets in close-up. There are a couple of things that come to mind, but one is that family portrait, which is the only image ever taken of almost all the planets. Mercury is just too close to the sun. That was made by Voyager 2, you know, by Carl Sagan's initiative. And it just shows how small all these worlds are compared with the sun and the blackness of space. And so for me, it's a really amazing thing to see. You know, they only look like dots or at best a few pixels of the bigger planets. But it really deserves to be better known. It's not just the Earth in that, but the whole solar system. And I think one of the most beautiful images for me is actually of Neptune and Triton. And you see them in a way that you can't see them from the Earth as crescents, because, you know, we just don't get behind them on Earth. And it's also that kind of swan song from Voyager 2 after its final encounter with a world. And it just makes me think about that tiny spacecraft beginning its journey into interstellar space after working so brilliantly for 12 years. And, you know, it's done another 35 years since that time already. And it also, I think, probably appeals to me because of things like the blueness of Neptune is somehow reminiscent. The crescents remind us a bit of our moon. And so, although it's obviously really alien, it's somehow very familiar as well. So that's definitely a tip from me.
Oh, Great shout. And if you want to send in any questions to us for a future episode, then please do. You can email podcast@ras.ac.uk or find us on Instagram. It's @supermassivepod. So shall we finish with some usual stargazing? Robert, what can we see in the night sky this month?
Well, we're definitely, although it doesn't necessarily always feel like it, we're definitely enjoying spring skies now. And so the Milky Way is, I know, slightly hard to believe given the weather we've had.
Spring skies in winter weather.
Yeah, exactly. Wrap up well. And the Milky Way is a lot less obvious, but the plus side of that is some of the more familiar constellations like Ursa Major, and within that, the Plough, if you're, or the Big Dipper, if you prefer, in the US, are high overhead. And do look out for that. If you look in the middle of the Plough's handle, or the Bear's tail, if you prefer, there's a classic double star, Mizar and Alcor, that you can see split with your eye. And if you have a small telescope, you can see that resolves into not just two, but four stars, because Mizar is a binary, and there's another distant, unrelated one between that and Alcor. And that itself turns out to be a binary as well. One time, I think we should talk about binary stars. There's simply so many of them. But it's only visible with large telescopes now. But, you know, small telescope will show you quite a lot. And other things to look for, we've got Bootes, and the bright star Arcturus is still really dominant in the sky. Leo the Lion is there. Virgo and Spica is really obvious as well. And if you've got a small telescope, you can pick out those distant galaxies. It's a good time of year to do that if the moon's not in the sky. And nearby those is a constellation which I quite like, just for its beauty, really. Corona Borealis, the Northern Crown, is one of those groups of stars that actually looks a bit like the object it's named for, and that's quite unusual in constellation shapes. And as we get closer to the June solstice, we obviously get, you know, there's a shorter and shorter period of darkness in the sky, and the nights get shorter. So the first part of May is good for looking at some of these fainter things I was thinking of before. And another target might be Messier 13 in Hercules, which is a big globular cluster. It's got several hundred thousand stars in it. It's not that hard to find if you get one of these apps or a decent chart. And if you get a pair of binoculars, you'll see a bright fuzz. And a moderate-sized telescope, you know, if you don't have access to one of those, go to, say, an amateur astronomy society. It just looks like this packed ball of stars. It's absolutely beautiful. Now, I should also mention that, as last month, we haven't got very many planets in the sky at the moment. But if you're up early enough, Becky, you can see Saturn before dawn. Just in case, if you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's some nice photo ops on the 4th of May and the 31st of May. It's near the moon, and in the second case, Mars is there as well. But really, to look at them in detail, you need to wait till later in the year when they're a bit higher in the sky and it's a bit easier. And the final thing I'll mention is that there is a meteor shower in May as well, the Eta Aquarius shower, which is on its best from the 5th to the 6th of May. And that's best viewed from the southern hemisphere. But even in the north, you might get anything between 10 and 30 meteors an hour. So probably divide that by two in terms of what you can actually see with your eye. And it's actually related to debris from Halley's Comet, so a quite nice evocative connection. And this year, if you're around at that time of night on the 6th of May before dawn, there's no moonlight to interfere with the view. So if it's warm enough and if you feel inclined to go out and there's a clear sky, then, you know, do go out for half an hour and take a look.
Amazing. All right, well, thank you. I think that's it for this month, and we'll be back next time with another bonus episode. And then after that, we're investigating the lunar standstill. More on that next.
Very mysterious. As usual, contact us if you try some astronomy at home. It's @supermassivepod on Instagram, or you can email your questions to podcast@res.ac.uk, and we'll try and cover them in a future episode or one of our bonus episodes. Until then, though, everybody, happy stargazing.